I'm Josh Braun, and this is Inside Selling, a podcast about selling without selling your soul, where I explore how to get better at selling through the simple acts of having integrity, being radically honest, and thinking like a buyer instead of a seller. I've had way too many conversations with people where they just started talking at me. They made a lot of assumptions about what I was saying, and they never really slowed down to ask me questions or demonstrated that they were curious about what I was saying. And every time I've been in one of these conversations, I've been so turned off by it that I rarely engage in future conversations. And I've been guilty of this too. Sometimes my mind wanders when someone's talking to me and I'm not truly in the conversation. That's why I am super excited to chat with Dan Oblinger about how to level up listening skills. Dan is a former hostage negotiator and author of Life or Death Listening. We've got a lot to cover, so let's dive in. So you're driving down the street, and as you drive, you see a group of people on the sidewalk, and they are all pointing upwards. You stop your car, you get out, you look up, and six stories above the street, you see a young woman is dangling over the edge of a parking garage rooftop. You find yourself standing face to face with this woman. She's about to jump. What do you do? What do you say? That is the beginning of Dan's book, and I'm delighted to have him on the podcast today. Dan, thank you so much for carving out some time, my man.
Josh, it's my pleasure. We are blessed.
Dan, what I would say is don't do it. You have so many reasons to live. And I think that's a lot of people's reaction, but not the best approach.
Yeah, we call those teddy bears. It's your natural response to something really stressful. And oftentimes, like a teddy bear, it feels good, but it doesn't do much good. And so you're not wrong to think that. You're not wrong to say it necessarily. It's just not going to work. So why is that? It's great because we build up these natural responses. It's adaptive. So it works in a sense, like it gets us through the thing. What we don't realize without a proper perspective, without some training, maybe I would actually argue without the right guide, without the right moral guide or skills guide, you fail to see that that was a huge opportunity for leadership and listening and communication and persuasion. And you might've missed it because you did something that's natural, but it's not skilled and it's not based on best practice. Yeah.
I think that's interesting because it's also our inclination to try to change someone's mind as sales professionals, right? That's kind of what I did when I was reading that passage out of your book and I was reflecting on it. My immediate reaction was, let me try to change this person's mind and convince her or him somehow that there's reasons to live.
Right.
And why does that often backfire when we kind of go into that mode of trying to persuade and change someone's mind with logical reasons?
One of the most prevalent, I call them again, communication teddy bears, is logic. So if I'm being irrational and I have behavior that's concerning to you, and you're not emotional, I mean, you're a very rational actor today. You want to help, you're very empathetic. You'll try to reason with me. Hey, let's be reasonable. You know, look, I mean, if you do this, this is really serious. Like people could get hurt. There could be this emotional contagion. Like you can give me 300 reasons not to jump, but the problem is they're your reasons. You haven't taken the time to discover who I am, why I'm up here, and what the interests are in my life, what's going on in my life that's led me up here. So that I think is the swing and the miss when we try to use logic and reason to persuade. And as a salesperson, right, as a professional trainer, a seller of sales, right? I think, Josh, you probably understand that. It's like there is a definite place for logic and reason in our appeals. But people are emotional buyers. If you can't wrap your head around that, you're not going to have a fun time in sales. Like we make all of our decisions, our emotional decisions. And a lot of times we use logic and reason too.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I was reading this particular passage from the book is very similar to a sales scenario. I would imagine when you approach someone who's about to jump off of a bridge, there's no credibility and trust. And mm-hmm. So when you start to give your take on things and you start to change someone's mind, just like you do when you hear an objection, where you try to convince people of all the reasons why they should do business with you, because you're biased and you don't have any credibility and trust, there's not a lot of, you know, trust. And is it the same thing you bump into when you run into someone jumping off a bridge, when you actually try to change their mind? You're like, who is this person? I have no idea who they are.
So hostage negotiators and crisis negotiators, you'll hear me use those terms interchangeable. We get one gift among, well, we probably get lots of gifts, but we have one huge gift, I think, after doing it for about a decade. And that is we, maybe more than other professions, recognize and work through and account for and directly address bias. I mean, we like to think that we're going to enter into this brand new relationship with somebody and we're going to do business with them, whether we want to talk them off a ledge or we want to sell them an amazing product or service. We want to think we start at zero, but that's because we fail to take into account human bias. You don't ever start at zero, right? You have either have a slight edge because of bias, or more likely you start in a huge hole. And the example I would use is from your profession. If you cold call me, right? And I recognize right away, this is a cold call, this is a salesperson. If I have a bias against being sold, which most human beings do, like we're all buying, but we don't want to be sold. That's an incredible distinction to make. Then you don't start out at zero, you start out in the hole. And as a police officer, like, and most people are very polite though. They're not going to be like, look, here's a deal. I don't trust you. You're a salesperson. I will never trust you. Go ahead and tell me what I'm going to let you waste your time with me, but I'm never going to buy from you. Like, nobody ever says that and then says, now go ahead. But people do that all the time with police officers. Like, look, you're a cop. I hate cops. I'm never going to work with you. I don't trust you. You probably think you're a negotiator, but that's not how this is going to go, buddy. Right? And they'll actually say that. So at least we have this gift of recognizing, okay, bias is here. I'm going to have to start not at zero, but in the hole. And so it's all about trust, which means it must be about listening to them and asking million-dollar questions that invite them to tell their story. And next thing you know, they forget that we're a police officer. We're just a story receiver. We're just an audience for them. And I think that's a really powerful way to overcome bias. But that first step is recognizing it exists.
I think that is actually a really incredible point, because as salespeople, and I fall into this trap too, we are so accustomed to trying to move things forward and to change minds and to persuade. And oftentimes, at least when I've tried to do that, people actually dig their heels in even deeper. There's a psychological bias called the backfire effect. You tell somebody, hey, whatever you do, don't eat cookies because you're going to gain weight. And it's almost like you want to eat more cookies.
Give me all the cookies.
Right. Someone's trying to show you, buddy. Right. Someone's trying to take your freedom away. A couple companies that I think do this really well, and would love to get your take on this. CarMax does this really well. If you've ever bought a car from CarMax, they are really transparent about what's wrong with the car. They don't tell you this is the greatest car ever. They actually show you what's wrong with the car. And they're very transparent about their pricing. There's no negotiation.
Right.
It's a calm place to be able to buy a car from, because they're not telling you all the benefits of the car, like if you go into any other car dealership. They're telling you the benefits and the drawbacks. Mm-hmm. And when you tell people the benefits and the drawbacks, at least I have found that you start to develop a little bit more trust. Progressive, I think that was the name of the insurance company, does this as well, where they were for a while there, where they were showing you the different prices of all the different insurance companies.
Yeah, and sometimes the other people had better prices. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what can we do as sales professionals, based on some of the work that you've learned in negotiation, to start to develop? I know trust takes time. It can't be done in 2 minutes. But what can you do as a sales professional when you're first starting off, even on a call, or when you start to hear objections, so that people don't put up the barrier? Because yes, I agree, they have negative stereotypes with salespeople. We've got bad reputations. How do we start to overcome that and start to develop a little bit of trust and credibility with people?
Well, if you want to borrow from our industry, because we're in sales, hostage negotiators are in sales, crisis negotiators, we sell things. We sell inpatient psychiatric care and prison. And we actually close almost all of our sales. And we have nothing, we joke that we sell with nothing to offer. Like, we're selling vaporware. We're not selling anything real, except you can say we're selling listening and empathy and trust. And so for that reason, we're actually selling everything. Like, that's what everybody wants. Like, everyone is our ideal client, which will cause your business to go out of business. But for hostage and crisis negotiators, it's what lets us succeed in these situations, because it doesn't matter who the person is, right? So one thing that we try to do to overcome these biases that exist and our natural defenses against being negotiated with or persuaded is we don't script anything. And I know that's tough because in sales, you know, there's best practices. And part of that is we know kind of as salespeople, right? Like here, there are certain things we can say that are persuasive, particularly when we know the product and service we're selling. Like we have these kind of best ways we like to showcase that product. But the problem is people are getting better and better at detecting scripts. As a practitioner, whenever I'm dealing with either a customer service rep or when people call me for sales, I can detect the script very, very quickly. And I have fun, you probably do this too, getting people off script so I can actually have a real conversation with a real live human being who just happens to work at a call center, right? Like they're trying to make an honest living and they're real and they've got all these real fears and hopes and dreams. And man, if you can punch through the script, you can have really amazing listening opportunities with them. So I say, don't use a script. You can use rituals, and that's a little different. So we have an opening ritual as negotiators where we're going to identify ourselves by our first name. We're going to demonstrate that we are different than all the other people they've been dealing with in the situation so far, that our primary purpose is to listen to them and be their trusted advisor if they'll let us, and they usually will eventually, but also then make it centered on them and their welfare. So it might sound something like this. Hey, I'm Dan. I'm working with the police department. I'm calling in. I'd like to listen to you and figure out what's going on. And if I can help you, I will. And it's simple, just like that. And it's not a script because it changes if the situation is different, because it always is. But the elements that don't change, the ritual is first name basis. It's about you. I'm here to listen. I have no official title, no official role. I just have a mission of listening to your story. And I'm obviously on the side of the police, but I don't even say that I'm a police officer or that I'm a negotiator, because those are titles of authority. And the purpose for that is people always want to know who you are. Why are you calling me? What do you want? And there you've handled that right there in your ritual, and you haven't scripted it yet, and you're not diving into a pitch. You're going to usually start with some good open-ended questions. And that there's no better way than getting away from scripts than to ask some open-ended questions where you can't control the answer. So that might be, I don't know, maybe a couple of things that we would lend to the sales process. I just think you got to be authentic. You have to be real. And you can't launch into a pitch at your first chance.
Okay, I want to delve into this a little bit because you said a bunch of things here. And I want to dissect and double click on some of the phraseology. And also I've noticed your tonality too, like how you sound. One of the things that jumped out at me immediately when I heard this was you used the word if. You know, my name is Dan. I'm with the department, you know, police department, and I'm here to understand your situation and help you if I can. And that word if, I think, is, at least to me when I heard it, really does a lot to build credibility and trust, because you're not assuming that you have all the answers.
Yeah, I don't know yet.
As sales professionals, we have a tendency to tell people
only
our side of the story, and we talk about the benefits, but we never talk about the benefits and the drawbacks. And so oftentimes when a prospect says, you know, why are you the best? We launch into all the reasons why we're the best instead of saying, I think if I'm hearing you right, Dan, hey, you know what? I'd love to tell you about the benefits and the drawbacks of our product. It's not right for everyone. Mm-hmm. I'd love to share the benefits and the drawbacks with you so that you can have a, you know, more informed decision to make your own choice.
It takes so much pressure off them, right?
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what I heard in you in that opening line there is not having, I think the takeaway here from what I'm hearing is not assuming that you have the right thing for everyone. Like, and I think when you walk in with the intent that your product is the best and that your job is to change someone's mind, I think that comes through in everything you say, rather than what I'm hearing you say, Dan, which is, hey, I'm here to listen. I don't know if I can help you. I just want to hear, you know, what's on your mind. And is that kind of the psychology behind it?
Yes. And again, it's not scripted. But we want to create this strong impression that we are not rushing in to tell them what to do. And oftentimes, again, we go back to the parking garage top, right, from the very, very beginning, where I think facetiously a little bit, but it's so true, is we want to yell, you know, don't do it. You've got a lot to live for. And the third thing is, I can help you. That's the third natural response to somebody in distress like that, is to say, I can help you. And in the mind of a person who doesn't know anything right now, I don't even know if I want to live. That is not a good footing to start out on from the standpoint of becoming the trusted advisor, from being very persuasive, because it assumes so much. It assumes that I want your help. It assumes that there is a way that I can be helped. It assumes that you're in a position to help me. I don't even know who you are yet. You don't even know who I am yet, and you think you can help me?
I love that.
And so translate that to sales, and it's all the same psychological dynamics. It's, hey, I didn't even know I wanted to buy anything today, and all of a sudden, like, here's this phone call, and this guy's telling me he can help me. He didn't even know who I am.
Right, right. And we hear this in objection handling, you know, all the time. I was reading a book. I think it was called Trust-Based Selling, and it was a great story in the book, I think, that dovetails in nicely with what you're saying, Dan, which was a person was going to drive a car at a car dealership, and she came back from the test drive and she told the car salesman she thought the car was a little bit noisy. And the inclination of the salesperson would be to explain to the person why the car, in fact, is not noisy, and to start talking about all the reasons why he or she should buy the car. That's the natural reaction we have when we hear an objection.
It's a teddy bear. Salesperson tell teddy bear.
And what this person was saying in the book, a different approach, which I loved, was, you know what? Noise levels in cars bother me too, especially on long rides. If you'd like, we can show you how the noise level in this car compares to the noise level in other cars so that you can make a more informed decision.
And okay, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. What about this though? I'll give you an option from this is probably what a hostage negotiator would do. They would say, it sounds like a peaceful drive is really important to you. And then she will, and then that's it. You let her talk. And she's going to agree with you in some fashion or another. She's going to say, yeah, that's exactly it. I just don't think this car, when I'm driving, I hear all this road noise. And then you pivot to the car that costs $5,000 more, but it's like a BMW. And you're like, well, I didn't know that before. Thanks for sharing. This car here is known for being a quiet ride. Let's hop into this one and take this one for a spin. Right? Mm. I mean, something like that. You identify the not the position. I don't like this car because it's noisy. Identify the interest, which is I really, when I drive, I want to be able to think and hear myself think, right? Or whatever it is. And then you pivot to an option that works for you that will meet that interest.
Yeah, I think Chris Voss, I'm sure you're familiar with him, obviously, being in the space. He refers to that as labeling, right? You're kind of labeling how someone feels. And again, really at the heart of this is empathy. And so let's actually talk about, because I think that's the theme here, is if people don't feel like you understand them and you're not on their side. And the car analogy is a really great one, because every time I've bought a car, the salesperson, not only I feel that they're on the opposite side of the table, they're actually, in fact, sitting on the opposite side of the table. And it always feels adversarial. And so I think the idea here is, how can you make people feel like you're on their side as a salesperson? And I think at the heart of that is letting go of the outcome. Being indifferent to the outcome and being okay that it might not be a fit at this time, and having an abundance mindset.
Yes.
But kind of getting back to this empathy piece, what are some of the mistakes or some of these bad listening habits? I know you read about this in the book, but I'd love to dissect a little bit about some bad listening habits that people get into. And I know as you guys are listening to this, you'll be like, oh my God, I do this all the time. And then we'll talk a little bit about like how we can start to build this muscle, because listening, like anything, like playing a sport or getting good at an instrument, requires awareness, you know, first that you're not doing it well, and then two, you know, how do you practice it? But let's start, Dan, a little bit with what are some bad listening habits that you often hear people make in your personal life and your professional life that you've seen?
Well, I'm going to start with kind of the foundation for it all, and that is we human beings have a natural tendency to look for ourselves, which sounds weird, but I mean, honestly, human beings, when we see a mirror, especially like a threefold mirror, like at a clothing store, right? We're checking ourselves out. Why? Are we admiring ourselves? No, we have this tendency to look for ourselves in everything. For instance, if you're a hiring manager and I gave you 5 resumes and I redacted the names, you're going to go through all the resumes, and whether you know it or not, you're going to be looking for similarities in those candidates based on their biographical information to you. Did they go to the same school as me? Did they get the same degree as me? Have they ever worked at the same companies as me or had the same roles as me? It's just this natural tendency. So that's not necessarily bad. I mean, it's bias. It can lead us into biased decisions, but where it becomes really awful is in listening. Because Josh, if I invite your story, but as you tell it, I'm listening for my own story, where you talk about fishing and you love to fish. And I'm like, I like to fish too. And you talk about a fishing trip where you caught a fish. I'm like, I caught two fish, you know. We dive in and at the first chance we get, which by the way, sometimes we manufacture our own chance to talk, which is called interrupting. We're going to talk about our story. This phenomenon is called associative listening. We tend to associate our story with other people's stories. It's not empathetic. It's horrible listening. It ends storytelling on the part of our partner. And it is a horrible habit. And that tendency is very human. Like, we all have that tendency. It manifests itself in so many different ways. So interrupting is a manifestation of this.
And interrupting meaning
so excited because you have reminded me something about my own story that it's so important. Hang on. I'm going to let you finish later, but I got to talk.
Right. This idea that you're listening so that you can talk and that you're trying to one up them. There's a, yes. I don't know if you've ever seen this skit. I think it's with Kristen Wiig on Saturday Night Live, but she plays this character where anytime anyone tells any story about like, hey, I went to Paris, she goes, oh, I went to Paris first. I was the first one in Paris. You know, I got this little hat. My hat's bluer than yours. It's this idea of one-upping in it. And that's so detrimental. Why? Because it takes the focus. It makes the other person feel like they are not being heard. Is that psychologically what's going on?
You're hijacking the story. Mm. It's theft. Nobody likes to be the victim of theft. And that's what you've done. You've, especially when you set the table, when you're like, you invite them to tell the story, and then your first chance, instead of reflecting on their story or asking questions that show that you're genuinely interested, going deeper into the storytelling, you're like, okay, great. Well, let me tell you about me. It's nobody likes it. And yet we all do it. I mean, it's a human tendency.
This happens all the time. So let's talk about this one because I see this happening all the time. I do it. I've had it done to me. So if we're aware of this, and I think awareness is the first step, if we know this is one of the deadly bad listening habits, I think the first step is thinking to yourself, okay, I'm about to go into this mode, and how do we now get better at this? How do we stop ourselves? Do you have any kind of tools that you use to work on this particular bad habit?
I mean, this is the thing, right? I mean, getting better. That's what I'm all about. I mean, it's nice to talk about theory, but it's really about practice. It's about being pragmatic with it. There, I will say this. I'll start with a recognition that there are certain schools, particularly of sales training, that teach their students to do this, and they call it rapport building, and they think that it is empathetic. You've seen this, right? You know, do your research about your sales target, you know, and find out what they like, and then talk about that. You're laughing because it's true. I've heard it on podcasts because I listen. Here's the thing. We have open systems, and if we're good about our craft with police crisis negotiations, and I'm also a private sector negotiator, I consult with businesses. So I'm constantly looking for other disciplines that can teach me to be better at what I do. So I listen to these other podcasts, these sales podcasts, and all the time they're like, just make yourself seem similar to, which is a persuasive principle, similarity or liking. That's true. But you can come about it so artificially by being like, So, do you like golf? Because I love golf. And like, yeah, I do like golf. Like, yeah, well, you know, I'm a scratch golfer. And I'm like, no, that's not it. That's not the thing.
So I think in your book, when I was reading it, I loved some of the phraseology that you used. And essentially the phraseology makes it easier for you to make sure that the conversation is focused back on the person. So like the phrase you have in your book, you know, tell me more about. What are some of these phrases that we can use when people are talking so that we don't get in this trap? Because I think oftentimes people feel like they want to keep the conversation going, and where their mind goes is, well, how can I turn it around? But in lieu of that, some people are probably thinking, well, what am I supposed to do or say? And to stay curious. And I think at the core of this, really, we'll go through some phraseology, but at the core of this, you really have to be genuinely curious about the other person. Because if you're not, it can seem like you're just faking it. And people can always tell when you're fake listening. I mean, Bill Nye has this great saying, everybody, I think Bill Nye is like, everybody new has something that they know that you don't know, which is, I love that saying. But if you're talking to someone, what are some phraseologies and what are some words that you can use or phrases that people can, you know, take out of their bag? And I know we don't want to be scripted, but sometimes when we're learning a new skill, sometimes we do need a little crutch to help us. Tell me about, I know is a great one in your book. Any other tips you might have for people in terms of getting people to keep sharing so that you can better understand them?
If you're in that initial mode of getting over objections by showing that you're not there just for the sale, and that you're not trying to rush them, and that you're not trying to take control of this conversation and show off features and use logic and reason. If you're in that mode, then I would encourage you, everything you say should be an invitation for them to tell their story. And the story is, it could be just of how they're doing today. It could be the story of like their orientation towards the products and services that you're going to potentially offer them. It might just be like just their story. Like, who are they? That's the litmus test for me, whether you're being empathetic and advancing the relationship and not the transaction. And that's so key, because most people ask questions and most people listen and it's a transaction. I'm giving you this so I can get something I need. And this is the exact kind of stuff that people are looking for, both in crisis negotiators and then salespeople, to invalidate what we're trying to do. They're looking for it. They're worried about it, right? And the longer we can go where they get to kind of, it's almost like you're dancing and they're leading.
I love that. I love that. It's almost like, you know, when you are starting to put your self-interest first, or you have ulterior motives, mm-hmm. People can sense that. It ruins your credibility. There's a woman at my gym. Her name is Anna, and she is like adored by everyone in the gym. And as a sales professional, I spent some time just dissecting when she would have conversations with me, like, what was she doing specifically that made me so drawn to her? And there was a couple things I noticed. One is that I always felt like I was the only person in the room. And people would walk up to her all the time while I was having a conversation with her. And she would just politely say, let me just finish up with Josh. And she would, you know, look at me, you know, dead in the eye. Even if her mobile phone went off, she wouldn't even look down at it. Something else she would do is she'd say stuff like, get out, or stop it, or tell me more about that, or what do you mean? And then the other thing she did that I thought was fascinating, and this might seem subtle, and I have a really hard time with this one, is when I was finished talking, she just wouldn't say anything for like a couple of weeks. She would just kind of nod her head a little
bit. She's a master, man. You've encountered a master. And they walk amongst us.
Talk about that, the power of just silence, because I have noticed when I try this, and it's really hard. It's easy to sit here on a podcast and wax poetic about it, but it's when you listen for just a couple beats when someone's done talking, they keep talking.
So, you know, so I do workshops for this, and it's based on my training as a hostage negotiator and all my years of experience. And I've found that, you know, these things translate so well to all human relationships, because that's all negotiation is for us, is I'm building a trust relationship with somebody that's biased against me, and I'm willing to put in the time and the effort and the pain. But it translates so well for all these other really important negotiations that go on in your life. But what it is, again, is getting away from transactions and getting into building relationships, because that's where sales come from. Like, you can sell anything to your best friend. Like, there's no pitch. You're like, dude, I need you to get this. It's so awesome. And they're like, I'm in. I'm done. I'm doing it right now. I'm on my phone right now doing it, right? But that's because you have a trust relationship. So probably Anna is either naturally gifted at all of these activities, or she's really put some time into her listening craft. And there's 8 active listening skills that we use, because variety is the spice of life, and life's not scripted, and everyone's different. And as relationships and conversations unfold, there's different needs. And one of those is just using silence strategically. And the cool thing is as you listen, like, the time to decide what to say is when they're done talking. And the human brain's amazing. Within a second, or maybe a second and a half, you can run through your 8 options if you've practiced. There's your keyword. And know the best possible response that honors what they just said, but also moves the conversation and the relationship forward. And what happens is, in that second and a half, as you're like, oh, you know what? I should really reflect upon the main idea here is that that she really loves her mom, right? You guess what happens is you look thoughtful about what they said because you are thoughtful about what they said. And there's your authenticity. And so then you take a second and a half to come up with the best possible response, and then you deliver it. And sometimes, this is the funny thing, in a second and a half, the other person kind of freaks out and they're like, oh, but here's more. And they keep going. You're like, oh, okay, never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah. What's hard about this is I'm always thinking about what I want to say next as I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you fight that urge? Because I've gotten into these situations where I'm thinking about what I want to say next. And when I do that, I'm really not in the conversation.
It's a
discipline. So I got away from your original question because it was kind of multi-part. So, okay, how do I practice? All right, so here's how you practice. First of all, you don't restrict improvement to practice. Like, start being a better listener all the time, and then you start recognizing all these conversations I'm having throughout my day. I'm getting my Starbucks. I'm gassing up my car, and there's a dude gassing up his car at the same island, right? I'm checking out at the grocery store. I'm at the doctor's office. I'm visiting my buddy, right? And he's not ready yet, but his receptionist is right here in front of me. These are all listening opportunities. And so it's important for us to see, okay, I've got 5 minutes with this Uber driver. How much can I learn about their day and how they're doing, like their emotional state right now? How much can I learn just by asking good questions and being reflective?
Let me ask you, I want to ask you, this is important, and I get this all the time. People like, well, I don't care about the Uber driver. Like, I don't really care. Like, if I'm have to be really honest with myself, Josh, like, I get what you're saying about listening and asking these questions, but I just don't care. Like, is that something I have to work on with myself? Like, do I have to get in a different mindset of like, well, like Bill Nye says, you know, everybody that you meet that you don't know has something that they could teach you that you don't know yet. I mean, do you ever bump into that where people are saying like, I don't really care about the Uber driver?
So many people tell me that. And so I just turn it around because it's what I do. And I just say, how come? How come you don't care about him?
Mm.
And they, if they're going to be honest, this is the honest truth. And it's hard to look at in the cold light of day. But if you're out there right now going, yeah, man, what Josh said, I don't care about that guy. I'm like, that's right. You don't care because you see people as valuable if they're useful to you. And you need to look to that. You got bigger problems than not being a good listener. Like, if you're not seeing people as independent, like autonomous people, human beings that are full of dignity, have an amazing story to share with you about themselves. And can teach you something, not just about them, but also about you, because that's how human beings become wise. And that's why the older you get, the wiser you should be, is because you've had all these encounters with real people. But if you can't see people for what they're really worth, which is they're worth an immeasurable amount, like they are invaluable, then you're probably never going to be a good listener.
Please,
I train people too. I'll go one further because the Uber driver is like, I mean, it's a random encounter. I'm talking about the man or woman in your life and probably in your office that you can't stand. Like, you can't, the thought of them is repulsive. I was at a keynote yesterday and this question came up. What if there's somebody in my life, I just really don't want to listen to them because I don't like them and I don't trust them. And my challenge to you would be, you're focused on the who they are, which is their personality and their quirks and their habits and all those idiosyncrasies that you can't stand, like how they go about their business. I can't stand them. And you're losing sight of what they are, which is they're the same as you. They have the same dignity, same value, same worth as you. It's immeasurable. And if you can start just thinking, you know what? Like, if there's a guy in your office you can't stand, okay, he was a little baby boy at one time in his life, and he was cradled in his mother's arms, right? Somebody loved him as a little baby boy, and just like you. Because what he is, he's an emotional social storyteller, just like you. And we've all have all these traumas that have made us the way we are in large part. And so if you can just honor and respect that and say, you know what, I bet for the same reason that I can't stand him, I bet there's so much I don't know about him. So I'm going to try to learn one thing about Dan that I didn't know. Maybe that'll help.
That is, guys, if you're listening to this and people, please rewind this two and a half minutes.
We just made this podcast 5 minutes longer.
please play that again. Something else, Dan, that I do, would love to get your take on this. And this is, again, I work on this all the time, which is, can I see people through a different lens? If I can't stand someone or someone's rubbing me the wrong way, can I turn that back and say, what am I doing that is utterly annoying this person? And can I see things through other people's lenses? Can I look at this through a different perspective? I hear this in sales all the time. People tell me, well, I called them and they weren't interested. And I said, well, maybe you're not interesting. Like, maybe you're not, like, right. What are you saying to be able to get them that way? And if sometimes shifting that lens a little bit, again, this gets back to empathy, can help. But I really love that point, and that's super actionable. Let me get your take on something else in your book. And this is something I bumped into 4 years ago. I want to run you by the scenario, and then we'll dissect what I did wrong and what people can learn from. So I don't know, about 5 years ago or so, I was in an enterprise deal that I'd been working for about 4 months, as enterprise deals are, they're an exercise in patience. And the finish line was me speaking to the person that was ultimately going to sign the contract. It was over, pretty much. It was a formality. And so my champion, who had the budget approval and everything, just said, hey, he just wants to, you know, have a quick conversation with you before he signs off on it this afternoon. That's how close you were, six-figure deal. And the meeting was set up with the guy that's signing the contract, the decision maker, as well as four people from his team, including my champion. And at some point in the conversation, he said, hey, it would be really great if I could see, you know, your hourly rates. And what I said is, why do you want to see our hourly rates? Why do you want to see our hourly rates?
Yeah.
And this guy completely came unglued. On this call. Why would you ask me that question? Of course I'd want to see this. And to make a very long story short, the deal completely unraveled. I didn't hear from them for 2 days. And finally my champion called me and said, this deal's off. You just rubbed the guy the wrong way and he's out. So Dan, let's dissect this. I certainly have replayed that, you know, over and over again in my head. And I would love to get your thoughts on what I did wrong and what a better approach would have been. Because I think a lot of people get in trouble with why questions.
Okay, so here's the deal. Like I see three different things here. And I wasn't there. And you've been thinking about this obviously for years. So what do you think? Like in 2020, what do you think it was?
So a couple things. One is, I think when you say to someone why, especially in front of their peers, it's almost like you're questioning their authority and their ego. You're almost like judging.
Yep.
Why are you even asking me this question?
Why is a horrible question?
You're being scolded. And,
like right now, everybody's turning this podcast off. You're like, no, why is the most important question? I learned that in college. And I listened to The Business of Authority and Why is Important, which is a fantastic podcast, by the way. I listen to it religiously.
Yeah. But so is that I think was definitely, you know, part of it. And also saying that in front of his peers also, I think, put him in a position of, you know, it hurt his ego as well. The other thing is I didn't seek to validate what it is that he was really trying to get at, because hourly rate pricing is not what he really wants. There's something underlying there. And if I could have said something like, you know, what are you bumping into here? Or, you know, if I would have just used a mirror, like hourly pricing, something like that, just to sort of get underneath it if I had a do-over. But those are some of the things that have been circulating in my mind that I've learned since, you know, listening to people like you and Voss.
Okay, so like I said, there's a couple things going on here that both as a negotiator, so primarily, you know, as my start, police negotiations, and now as a business consulting negotiator for especially engineering firms, if you're out there. All right, there's my shameless plug. Here's some things that are going on. It is super, super common, and you're in sales, and hopefully everybody in sales recognizes this, that you're going to have what I like to call the final test. So in our police negotiations, like we'll negotiate for 4 hours with somebody, and we go from like stark raving mad, screaming at us, cursing at us, shooting at us at times, not really at us, but at the perimeter. And in the course of about 4 hours, it becomes where first name basis, appropriate humor, full disclosure, all these signs of complete and total rapport, much like you going into that last meeting, right? You're like, this is a done deal. Like we're chilling the champagne, baby. It's Miller time, right? And then what happens is, and we have to recognize this, because surrender in my world is much like sales in the world I consult in now, is this is a big deal, especially enterprise deal. This is a huge investment. This is a relationship we're going to have now with you, the seller, right? And there's always this fear of a bad deal. And so to convince ourselves, to make us feel good about signing the dotted line, or in my case, leaving the trailer home and coming out and laying down in the street, right, with the SWAT team, like, one final sniff, one final test. And I like movies. It is very much like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. Like he's gone through all of these trials and tribulations. He ends up in this chamber with this old knight, right? And the movie's about over, but he's got one final test, you know, choose the right cup. And that's what this is. So the first thing is, we're like, hey, this thing's a done deal. And we let our guard down and we slip into those teddy bears. Because we are talking way more freely now with this person because we have a relationship. So, and you had your champion there, and this is the buyer, and this is about to happen. And we fail to realize this is the last test, and we have to be on our A game. It's not that it's easier. Actually, what I find is this last little vignette with my buyer, you know, my subject, can be oftentimes be the trickiest, because the emotions are no higher than this. They're about to lose control in this procurement, because once they sign, they're committed, right? So understanding that that's the last test. And then the second thing is understanding that because of that is this is a super emotional period. And asking why to emotional people is about the dumbest things we do as a negotiator or a salesperson. And the why conversation and the issue of why are absolutely critical, and you have to discover that. But using the word why as a police hostage negotiator, I try never to say the word why, because we're always dealing with people that are emotional and effective. And it's the reason is exactly what you said, man, exactly what you said. There's this, unless you land it perfectly with the exact right tone and probably a very long longitudinal relationship with this person where they've trusted you for a long time, unless you have those things in your back pocket, like, it's not going to work, because they will hear invalidation in your voice. Because if you ask me, what's your hourly rate? And I say, well, why? It's like, well, you're kind of dumb for asking that. Like, that's what they hear. And again, this is at precisely the moment where they're doubting their decision to buy from you. And then you drop your guard and say, why? And I hate to do this to you, Josh. You didn't do anything wrong, because you're just doing your best. But and then the last thing I would say is, you don't have to, like you've already pointed out, you don't have to say why, because there's so many other options, better options to say.
Well, let me put you on the spot. So let's rewind this a second. And I'm going to be the decision maker. And sure, you're going to be the salesperson. And I'm just going to role play this a little bit, just so you guys can hear the approach that would be, you know, more effective. Because most conversations that I've had early in my career have been unproductive conversations. They are, mm-hmm. they're me using the why. They're shutting people down. They're me stepping over people. They're me not listening to what people are saying or trying to overcome or change minds. We've been talking a lot about that. So I just want everyone to hear, you know, what it sounds like to have a more productive conversation and to start with empathy and understanding and not confrontational. So I'm going to be the decision maker and Dan's going to be the rep. And I want you to listen to not just Dan's words, but I also want you to listen to the tonality or how he's saying what he's saying. Because you could deliver the same exact thing that Dan's going to deliver, but if you deliver it in a amped up way, it can be perceived very differently. So, you know, hey, nice meeting you, Dan. I just got, you know, a couple questions for you. I would love to just get your hourly rates.
Ooh, hourly rate?
Yeah. We'd like to see like which of the pieces of the project, how many hours they take, and we'd like to know like how much money you charge for those hours.
Okay. Sounds like that hourly rate for those pieces is going to be really critical here.
Okay. And I want to out of role play for a second. And I want to just see what's, there's two things that went on there. One of them was, sounds like you used a mirror. Can you just explain real briefly? I know some people might not know what that was, that technique where you just kind of repeated the last two or three words back to what I said. You said, you know, I'm sorry, hourly rate, with a little slight uptone there. Talk a little bit about the power of a mirror and why you used it.
Using their own words, super persuasive, very non-threatening. It's words that they felt safe and comfortable using, and so that's what we use. If you're going to walk in a minefield, walk right behind the person who laid the mines. And the second thing is, I'm not going to talk very much at all. If I'm just repeating a couple words back with a tone that says clearly, I heard what you said, I recognize this was an important part of what you said, and I'd like to know more. Please continue. And then that's what they will do.
Yeah. And then you also use the label. Talk a little bit about labeling. You call it in your book sort of repackaging or paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Another technique. Talk to us a little bit about what that is and why that's so important as well in terms of making people feel understood.
Yeah. Paraphrasing is a variation on that theme of mirroring. I'm still not going to say very much. I'm still, with my tone and with the word selection, going to indicate, I heard what you were saying. I think this is important, and please continue and explain it some more so I can understand some more. But the difference is I'm going to pull out from what was said the main idea. Could be a motivation that I heard, could be a belief that I think they have, could be a value I think they place on something. I love to use this technique because it is a technique, but I've learned through practice and experience whenever someone mentions a third party, another person, that that's super important to invite the story of, because there's a reason why they mentioned them. That's this person's influential or they're going to be an obstacle. So
yeah, you know,
Chris, yeah, great Voss, technique.
This is something else that's really difficult to do. Chris Voss writes about this, and it's really difficult to pull this off. And I want to get your take on it because I've been trying to practice it. It's not just repackaging it and saying exactly back what they said. That's okay. But what Chris, I think, gets to in his book is, can you actually articulate the underlying emotion or feeling that they're really feeling and saying that to them, almost as if they couldn't even say it themselves? And the example that he uses in his book is when his son was playing football, and mm-hmm. I think his name was Brandon, and he was moved to a different position, and he felt like he was less of a man. He's like, Dad, I don't want to play that position. And so Chris Voss said something like to the effect of, hey, it sounds like you feel like if you're in this other position, you know, you're going to feel like not as tough, and you're going to feel like you're not, you know, not as strong. Even though right. Brandon didn't say that, that's kind of what he was right. thinking. And from there, you know, he got the magical, you know, that's right, Dad. Yeah. That is really tough to pull off. And I think I would love to get your take on it, because if you miss that and it's not what they were thinking, I would imagine it could go sideways. But talk to us a little bit about this idea of being able to really express the underlying, you know, feeling that people have.
You just have to organize your thoughts about that technique, and you have to practice it. It just takes reps. It takes practice to listen and know which way to go with this paraphrase or the repackaging process. Mm-hmm. And the more people talk, the better you'll get. You'll have more points of data to recognize what's important. In a sales situation, I would lean towards what's motivating them to buy, what they value in your product or service, or what they're concerned about in your product or service, or even in your delivery, like your sales pitch. If they mention third parties, you should definitely say, ooh, it sounds like, and you don't even have to make it a true value-based statement. It might be like, ooh, you mentioned Josh. It sounds like Josh is going to be really important in this process. Like, you don't know if it's good or bad, but you heard that this is important. And that's the other thing too, which we try to stay away from good and bad, just what's important. What's on their mind? What's top of mind for them? And if that's what you can paraphrase out of what they're saying, that's a huge, huge step towards trust. And you're getting towards the why without having to ask why.
I love that.
What's interesting is, you know, again, you got to start. Good listeners do ask themselves once a person stops talking, hey, why did they tell me that? If this deal is so close, why are they picking this one part of the deal to really focus in on and make an issue of? And okay, so there you go. There's your motivation as a listener. Hey, let's try to discover this.
I love that. It's almost like you're like being Columbo. Let me hit you up on one more thing.
One last thing. Yeah, turn around. here's another pro tip. We didn't get to it, but if you really do, you're like, I absolutely have to ask why. Then don't say why. Say how come. Say, hey, how come this is coming up? Kind of hear it, you know, at the last minute. It seems important.
Yeah, right. let me run another idea by you, because I still replay this, even though it's been 7-8 years ago. I still replay it, and another technique that I learned, I picked up from Voss, and I'd love to get your take on this. Is, and I've been using this a lot, and it's been super effective for me. I think Chris calls it an accusation audit, and it sort of sounds like this. You know, hey, Dan, you know, it sounds like looks like you want hourly pricing. Hey, this is going to probably come across as one of the stupidest questions you've ever heard. But what is it about hourly pricing that is important to you?
Yep.
You know, something like, I don't know if that's the right phrase, but this idea that you're almost falling on the sword a little bit. Someone says, I just had this happen actually last week on a deal where I said, you know, essentially is there budget for this? And the guy like lost his mind. Cause again, it was in front of three or four of his peers.
Yes.
Like, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it was. Instead of, I should have just said, hey, this is probably going to sound like a really salesy question, but I got to ask it just as way of protocol. Would it be okay if we discussed the money? You know, just that accusation audit at the beginning, or this idea of falling on the sword. Chris uses this term, you know, I'm an asshole, something like that.
Yeah.
That's what he uses in his book. But would love to get your take on that, Dan, in terms of a, you know, again, not a script, but just this concept of an accusation audit. With regards to lowering barriers and making conversations more productive.
Yeah, it's more of a ritual in the sense that, okay, oh, we've recognized this is a point where we need to take some error out of their objections. And maybe we want to ask a tough question here, but we also want to soften the blow. And so I call it prefacing. You're going to preface your question. So you're going to talk a little bit more than you might normally when you're going to ask a good question. But it's because you absolutely have to address these unspoken, these elephant in the room kinds of objections, or you're going to be beating your head against the wall because you've hit a trust barrier. And there's no point in doing anything else until you kind of bring the barrier down. And Chris Voss really alludes to that. He discusses that when he talks about these accusation audits, and he's spot on. He's right. And I think you should preface it and say, hey, look, you know, I hate to ask this question because, you know, it might look like I'm just prying, but what I'm actually trying to do is I'm trying to, you know, make a marriage here. I'm trying to match the right process on our side of it to what you guys are looking for. Or you could be as simple, like with the hourly thing, just like you kind of, I think you've thought through this, obviously. But to say, hey, this may shock you. And like, I hope this doesn't, you know, scare you, but you know, our hourly rate is this. What do you think about that?
Right. Or if I didn't want to divulge,
how would that fit?
Yeah. Or if I didn't want to divulge hourly pricing for, you know, as agencies, we normally never want to divulge.
Right. You don't want to do hourly.
We don't want to divulge hourly pricing. You can kind of get at what is it that he or she really wants, because hourly pricing, again, it's a means to an end. And so if you can kind of use this accusation audit and say, this is probably going to come across as really a stupid question. Tell me what are you up against here? So that I could best get you what you need. What are you, hoping this hourly pricing is going to allow you to do better? And then maybe go ahead.
Well, you also have done all this due diligence. I mean, you've done all your qualification up to this point, because again, this is the last test. Like, you should be armed with the best knowledge now. So you might feel comfortable saying something like, it sounds like cost overruns are a concern. And then they'd be like, yeah, I need to know your hourly rate, because if this goes too long, that's when you can come back with it. Well, we're pricing this based on value. You're going to pay this rate no matter how long it takes us. And that aligns your concern with our concern, is we don't want to get sucked into a deal that takes forever. So we're going to be motivated to get it done at the highest quality at the earliest possible time, because we don't make any more money if we take longer.
See, that's brilliant right there. I love that, because that's exactly what I was talking about a few minutes ago, which is what's really the underlying thing, which is really cost overruns. Like, if you have the business acumen to understand why would someone ask that question, and you know that, and you know that the reason they're asking it is exactly what you said, you could say something like, it sounds like, in a very, you know, calm voice, and I know you write about this a lot in your book, it sounds like you'd like to know hourly rates, because the last thing you want is to have any kind of cost overruns.
Yep.
And then if you just shut your mouth and you were quiet and you delivered that in a nice way, and again, to your point, something really magical does happen when you don't try to overcome it, when you let people actually talk and express, they're just more open to what it is that you have to say. So,
and here's the thing, the more we try to script it and the more we train ourselves about objections and overcoming objections, and we develop these phrases that work in some cases in sales situations, the more you're going to be tempted to go to your teddy bear. And when they bring up this issue of hourly rates, you're like, oh, hourly rates objection. And you slip you slip out of this real unique interaction with two specific people talking about a specific deal in a specific time and place. And you're going to slip back to your training where, okay, if they say this, we say this. And you're going to accept what they said at face value and then go launch right into a scripted response. And that is exactly what they're going to recognize. Yeah. And so this final test, I mean, you have chosen poorly. I mean, that's what it's gonna feel like, because they were looking for authenticity and somebody that we can trust. And instead, what you gave them was a cookie cutter approach. And nobody likes to be a cookie and get cut.
Yeah, and this I love that. So this is not going to make you just a better salesperson. This is going to make you a better person as
that's
well
what I think.
In your business and in your personal life. Dan, you have said it all. So much gold in this podcast. If people want more of Dan, they want to learn more about you, how do they do that?
Well, I think they should go to LinkedIn and connect to you and me if they haven't done that yet, because that's free and it can't hurt. And once or maybe twice a day, I'm going to put out content that reminds us of the importance of listening and gives us a practical tip on negotiating. And that's it. If you want my books, they're on Amazon, paperback and ebook. There's Life or Death Listening, a Hostage Negotiator's How-To Guide to Mastering the Essential Communication Skill. And that is the 8 Active Listening Skills and kind of my story of how I decided that was going to be my craft And then the second one is the 28 Laws of Listening. And that is a 4-week program to build better habits as a master listener. I do consulting and I do workshops and I do keynotes. So if you have an opportunity there, hop on my website, www.masterlistener.com, and let's chat.
Dan, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Josh, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for the absolute humility of sharing what you feel is a failure in your past and using that as a learning lesson, because that was amazing.
I've got many more.
I'm going to get you way better in those situations now because of your reflection.
I'm in a constant state of beta.
That's okay. Well, then you're moving forward. That's awesome.